Welcome to Thursday night's program. Program note, tomorrow night we will be doing a rebroadcast of the Molloy Show. Kathy and I and Molly are going to head up to the North Georgia Mountains and stay there. Well, just over the weekend. We should be back Monday. I was reading the Times this morning, and I saw a little letter to the editor that I don't have in front of me who wrote it, but I remember what the gist of it was. And it, in just two, three, four sentences, the letter writer captured for me the horror of not just our two invasions and occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan, but I guess in the bigger picture, all of our wars for the past 50 years, the futility and the insanity. The writer referenced some of the casualty numbers, some of the casualty figures recently. A lot of American soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan over the past week, 10 days. And the writer pointed out that when the war in Afghanistan started, which was October 2001, 9 years ago, the kids that are being killed, the 18, 19, 20, 21, 22-year-olds, were children. They were children. A 19-year-old who is killed in Afghanistan because of the demands for his blood by capitalist America, that child, 20 years, let's just call him 20, was 11 years old when this war started. Now, 11 years old, you know, that's a fifth or sixth grader. Call a sixth grader. This little boy was in the sixth grade at some public school, one assumes, someplace in the United States. And because of Bush and Cheney's insanity and the refusal of Barack Obama to declare this butchery over, this little kid, who was 11 years old when this started, this little kid is now dead. And when you think of it that way, you think about his lifespan. I mean, you can look at the death notices the New York Times publishes on a regular basis, what they call names of the dead. American servicemen, their names, where they're from, their ages, rank, and how, in some instances, how they were killed in Afghanistan. And if you look at those, I don't know how you cannot kind of scope back over this child's short life. How did he become somebody in Afghanistan, in a combat zone, being blown into pieces? You know, we can, maybe I've been thinking about this lately because I have a six-year-old. Maybe that's it. Maybe if I did not have a six-year-old, Maybe if I just had the children that I have, all grown adults, all with their own families, maybe I wouldn't be thinking this way. But it is impossible not to mark the progress of a child that is in your, under your command and control, which Molly is, and be my age. My age to her age is an astonishing thing, because I'm not like a 25-year-old father or a 35-year-old father. I've got the scope and observation of a lifetime. I mean, of a full life. If I were to die tomorrow, I would have led a full life and not far from the so-called biblical allotment of time. So, watching Molly's progress keeps me keenly aware of other children. And other children who are no longer children, but they shouldn't be being blown into pieces in Afghanistan. And I read that letter to the editor this morning and thought about sitting there and crying. And I thought, no, that's kind of useless to sit here at the table and cry. But I just wonder about all those kids that were 10 and 11 and 12 and 13 years old when these horrible invasions of these two countries began. I mean, what? I don't know. Sometimes it's almost like overwhelming, because I'll sit there and think, what do these kids think their lives are going to be like? You know, what is a 10-year-old? I asked Molly, she's 6, okay, there's a difference. What do you want to be when you grow up? She wants to be a waitress. Because it looks like fun to her. But I wonder about these kids, these little boys, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. Had they been asked, when George Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and these neocon killers condemned them to death, I wonder what they would have said when they were 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. Hey, what do you want to be when you grow up? And knowing, as I do, and you do, if you've had children or you have nieces and nephews, whatever, knowing how fast it goes by, the time, from an adult perspective. Molly was born yesterday. All of a sudden, she's 6. Boom. And I think about these families. You know, their kid was 11 years old, and they pick up the paper and read that George W. Bush has invaded Afghanistan. And they're sitting at their breakfast table reading their New York Times 9 years ago. And maybe the mom looks up at the dad and says, I'm just reading here in the paper, George, about looks like we're in another war. Maybe the mom and dad look at their two kids, you know, 11-year-old boy and a 8-year-old little girl, and maybe a 3-year-old sitting in a high chair or something. And the parents sit there and say, well, you know, not our kids. Another kid's dead. I can't tell you how profoundly that got to me this morning. These little kids, little boys, just learning just the bare essentials necessary to their survival. 8 years old, 9 years old, 10 years old. And nobody sitting around that breakfast table would have a clue that within a decade that child would be dead, blown to pieces, because of the madness and greed and filth of our political leaders. It's pretty hard to deal with. We'll take a break here in just a moment and come back and get into the program. I guess we are into the program, aren't we? Oh, if you want to call in tonight, feel free. The number is 877-996-2556. 877-996-2556. We'll be right back.
Dying, come on. If you're tired of the fighting, come on. No more wars, no more lying, come on. All my people in the world, come on. Every boy, every girl, come on. If you know it ain't over till God says that it's over, come on. Come on, let's go.
Someday,
we'll put it together and we'll get it all done. The world is much brighter.
Hey, truth seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Oh, and by the way, what I have planned for the third hour tonight is solutions. Solutions, okay? Not the usual ranting and screaming that you get from me. Well, I never can tell whether or not I'm going to start ranting and screaming, but I've got some ideas about some solutions to everything. So stay tuned. It'll get you launched into your Labor Day weekend, which no longer has any meaning whatsoever. Certainly not the meaning that was intended by it, when the holiday was designated. Well, I guess we can still, use Labor Day as a way of acknowledging the deaths of all the workers in this country, organizers who tried to bring a better standard of living and a better life for Americans. But anyway, third hour tonight, stick around, because if I know me, and there's one thing I do know is me, it'll probably be a doozy. You know what I'm saying? Oh, by the way, did you see the story today? An oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, offshore petroleum platform, about 100 miles off the Louisiana coast. Nobody killed yet. All 13 people aboard the rig, according to the Associated Press, were accounted for. One injury. The extent of the injury was not known. They were rescued from the water by an offshore service vessel. Seven Coast Guard helicopters, two airplanes, and three cutters were dispatched to the scene from New Orleans, Houston, and Mobile, Alabama. The latest I have is, and I haven't seen any updates, nobody really knew if anything was leaking from the site. The platform known as Vermilion Oil Platform 380, owned by Mariner Energy of Houston. Platform was not producing oil and gas, according to an operations report. The platform was authorized to produce oil and gas at the water depth that it was working, but had not recently been in active production. And nothing to worry about, because this one is only in 340 feet of water, not 5,000. So, okay, you know, everything's cool. It's not a deep water accident, it's shallow water. I guess we're all glad to hear that, aren't we, huh? There is a article out. You can go to the website, vanityfair.com, about Sarah Palin. That is an absolute brain scrambler. I mean, if you read this, and apparently Palin has gone ballistic, hit very close to home, I'm sure. It talks about her her control freakishness, her temper, her short attention span, a poseur when it comes to hunting. She's never hunted, according to a family friend. She has persistent feelings that she is underappreciated. She flies in private jets and drives a gleaming new Cadillac Escalade SUV with tinted windows. Oh, and Fox News may be building a studio on her property. You got to read this. I read part of it today. I'll read the rest of it over the weekend. But what a psychopath this woman is, coupled with her phony cast out the demons Christianity. Wouldn't she make a great president? Huh? Hell, man, she'd make just one hell of a president. You go there, Sarah. Oh, my Lord. Oh, well. Last minute, before we went on the air, I got an email from Bridget, one of our ethics advisors to this program. And she, what she sent me is, I think I'm going to share with you when we come back after this break. Just when you think that things could not get sleazier and filthier and more corrupt in the remains, the bowel scatterings, the fecalite of the Republican Party slash teabaggers, something like this that I'm going to share with you, a guy sticks his head up out of the swill and wants to be elected to Congress. So you don't want to miss this. I'll share it with you when we come back. And if you're on hold, all right, I'll get to you. Just hang with me for a while. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Nothing gets me hotter than polar bear slaughter as we wipe out every otter with tons of oil in the water. Put that former beauty queen in a Hummer limousine. Add some Vaseline and send in the Marines. I'm thinking about nailing Sarah Palin with her leather leggings flailing. I've been screwed by politicians, but never with my permission. And though her politics are chilling, I find her booty thrilling. I Googled her today and I'm emailing to say I'm thinking about nailing Sarah Palin.
What is it exactly that the VP does?
Sarah, I'm hunting you like the mighty caribou. I'm bringing up my pipeline. You bring the harp seal stew. Oh, baby, I'm thinking about nailing.
Standing up to the flying monkey right, it's Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. Anyway, Bridget Wolf sent this to me. Subject line is as ugly as it gets. She writes, Mike, John and I were on the southern Oregon coast earlier this week and saw a lot of signs for a candidate for Congress whose name we didn't recognize. Since all but one of Oregon's delegation are Democrats, I figured this guy must be the Republican and decided to check him out when we got home. Bad idea. I almost lost my lunch. I know these, quote, people, end quote, are out there. They have been for a lot of years, but they've been hanging out in their burrows on the fringe. Now they're endorsed by a major political party to run for Congress. I really don't recognize this country anymore. And then she sent me a link to this crazy... watch your language, Mike. Candidates website. Art Robinson, Oregon GOP candidate for Congress, sells a book on his website comparing Africans to retarded children. And the article is from alternate.org. Running against Democrat Peter DeFazio for a congressional seat in Oregon's 4th District, Art Robinson is one of the most influential and leading global warming denialists in America and has proposed dumping all of our radioactive waste and crude oil waste into the sea. But wait, there's more. For the better part of a decade, at least, Mr. Robinson has been reprinting, marketing, and selling a virulently racist 19th century English boys' adventure novel that suggests Africans are like retarded children. The title is By Sheer Pluck by George Alfred Henty. It is set in Africa and features a sympathetic character patronizing Africans as, quote, just like children, and declaring, quote, the intelligence of an average Negro is about equal to that of a European child of 10 years old. Left alone to their own devices, they retrograde into a state little above their native savagery, end quote. Now, over the last decade, Art Robinson, the Republican candidate for Congress, his homeschool curriculum business, oh, there's a surprise, has sold thousands of copies of this book. Arthur Robinson has carved out a niche selling a Christian homeschooling curriculum developed by his now dead wife, who, according to Robinson, compiled the curriculum from material culled from Christian homeschooling curricula published from Bob Jones University. The Robinson self-teaching curriculum includes, as a reference for students, a 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica and a King James version of the Bible written in 1611, which, quote, is the foundational book of the curriculum, end quote. As a 2001 article in the American Spectator described, quote, R. Robinson's family members have developed a homeschool curriculum consisting of over 200 books. Among them, the 30,000-page 1911 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which the youngsters took turns scanning into computers. The curriculum was transferred to 22 compact discs, which are sold in a box for $195. Over 4 years, 20,000 sets have been sold. More recently, with typical single-mindedness, Robinson tracked down all 99 historical novels by the Edwardian writer G.A. Henty, and they in turn were optically scanned. 3,000 Henty sets, 6 CDs, were shipped in the first year. They retail for $99, end quote, American Spectator. Now, here's what Art Robinson's homeschooling curriculum website has to say about George Alfred Henty's books, the ones that say, well, you know, about Africans and the white man's burden. Here's what, now, granted, it was written in the 19th century. This website was put up a few months ago. Here's what it says. Our initial printing emphasizes the wonderful collection of historical novels written by G.A. Henty. While some of these books have been in print, two-thirds of them have been out of print and generally unavailable to homeschool readers. G.A. Henty wrote at a time when the teaching of a deep Christian faith, high moral character, sound ethical principles, a strong work ethic, simple personal humility, and self-confidence based on real accomplishments were considered essential to the education of each young person. This is in sharp contrast to today's tax-financed schools, where these values are deliberately excluded. The Henty books provide training in history and in many of the highest aspects of human character, while holding the attention of the reader with tales of adventure written by a master storyteller. Not only do Henty's heroes serve as excellent examples to people of all ages, his own vocabulary, grammar, and literary skills serve as outstanding examples to young writers, readers, and speakers of the English language. In learning to write, as in learning to speak, the examples that children follow are the most important factors in their accomplishments. American young people should read not a few Henty books, but all 99 of them. Taken together, they constitute a superb course in world history and an education in some of the highest aspects of human behavior in the heroes, and some of the lowest aspects in the villains. In his 1884 novel, By Sheer Pluck, in a chapter titled The Dark Continent, Mr. Henty wrote, quote, "The intelligence of an average Negro is about equal to that of a European child of 10 years. A few, very few, go beyond this, but there are exceptions. Living among white men, their imitative faculties enable them to acquire a considerable amount of civilization. Left alone to their own devices, they retrograde into a state a little above their native savagery." Oh. It goes on and on and on. Gary North is a protege of the founder of the Christian Reconstruction Movement, Rufus J. Rushdoony. Now, these are the bastards that are the reason I carry a loaded weapon almost all the time. In 1992, Rushdoony spoke at the inaugural event of the U.S. Taxpayers Party, later rebranded as the Constitution Party. In 2008, Ron Paul endorsed the Constitution Party candidate for President of the United States. And current Kentucky Senate candidate Rand Paul keynoted a Minnesota Constitutional Party rally in 2009. Rushdoony advocating executing by stoning homosexuals, adulterers, and women who have intercourse before marriage. Stone them. He wanted to reimpose slavery, claimed that African-American slaves were lucky, was a Holocaust denier, a creationist, and maintained that the sun rotates round the earth. The homeschooling curriculum by Arthur Robinson, who wants to be a representative from Oregon, is, quote, "for parents concerned about socialism in the public schools," end quote. It contains many references to Rushdoony, including a 51-minute audio recording of an interview with the now dead, thank you God, Christian Reconstructionist Titan. This guy who wants to be a member of the congressional delegation from Oregon was a signatory to something called a scientific descent from Darwinism. It's a statement in 2001 from the creationist Discovery Institute that challenges the theory of evolution. Mr. Robinson, in 1986, co-authored with Dr. Gary North, the one I was just telling you about, a book on how to survive nuclear war titled Fighting Chance, 10 Feet to Survival. The book advocated bringing back the so-called duck and cover civil defense approach promoted by the U.S. government civil defense film Duck and Cover, shown in U.S. schools to children, school children in the 1950s and 60s. Gary North, a leading Christian Reconstructionist theologian, prolific writer, author, I should say, and former congressional staffer for Texas Congressman Ron Paul, has endorsed Art Robinson's congressional campaign. I mean, for Christ's sake, how far do we have to pitch this country into a sewer of ignorance and religious nonsense and this crazed right-wing swill personified by people like Palin and Palin and Beck and all of these monsters that are roaming the United States? Is there a cutoff point, Truth Seeker? Is there a point where the American people say, okay, we've had enough? These people are a threat to the continuation of our lives. We are going to end it all. How long? How long before we get to that point? Like me. Skin color blinded, conspiracy minded, protesters of corporate greed. We who have nothing, and most likely will till we all end up locked up in jail. Conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American man. Think more than this, think twice. It's just another day in you. You
Get your news unfiltered, only with Mike Malloy.
It is 10 before the hour. CG is in Cleveland, Ohio, listening on Sirius. Hello, CG.
Hey, Mike, how are you and all your loved ones?
Pretty good. How about you?
Hey, I got a new name for you, man. I call you Primetime Mike. Mike, I call you that because you compete in primetime, cuz. This is the God's truth. You're competing against a whole bunch of stuff on TV.
That's true.
A whole bunch of stuff on the radio. You're doing this 9 to 12 slot.
You know,
and
you know
think
what?
About, huh?
And you know what? That's why I'm so poor.
Hey, but we're both proud, poor bastards, Mike, but don't worry about it. We still got our pride and we ain't for sale.
I
look at it this way. I think Limbaugh, Beck, and Sarah Palin, they're all pimps, but you know, pimps flip too. So they got a whore for the corporations. They're very careful about who they'll allow to urinate in their face, but they'll perform a fellatio on any corporate person. Hey.
Yeah.
Hey, now, I call them.
Now,
but
remember,
you know,
CG, remember, we're not just on Sirius and XM. We're also on radio stations, so be cool.
That's, oh yeah, no profanity will come out.
Okay.
But I call their listeners the Fright Wing because these are these over-caffeinated zombies that they pick up in the morning at 9 o'clock. They're sitting at work bored. They don't have nothing else to do. So anything they'll listen to, then Rush gets his at 12 o'clock, you know?
Right.
And so they've had their second dose of caffeine, so they're sitting there picking their noses or whatever they do. But again, you have to have something, you know, provocative to say or something that's cerebral to get us to listen.
Uh-huh.
Because there's so much else to do from 9 until 12.
How's it working?
It's working good. I dig your hate and anger, man, because your hate and anger, it protects us from their anger, their hate, and their insanity. And at least you use it in a constructive way.
Well, that's an interesting take on what I do, CG, and I think you're...
Well, hate is a natural emotion, because it's there, and anger is a natural emotion. People try to pretend like these things don't exist. This is part of the human genome.
That's right. That's
right. And it's a protection.
That's
it's
right.
Truly a protection. You know, it protects us from other things.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, but anyway, I admire you because you're not for sale. You're the closest thing to Malcolm X that's on the radio, and that's a big compliment. I grew up listening to him, and you bring it just like he brings it, Mike.
Well,
he was,
I really do believe that a hero ain't nothing but a sandwich, but I'll tell you what, there have been a lot of prophets of the truth, and I think that, I read the autobiography of Malcolm X a long, long time ago. And when he came back from his trip to Mecca and came to realize the idea of equality of justice and equality of people, and of course it was shortly after that that he was assassinated, as always happens to people with insight, that would affect the course of history. Eventually they're brought down. Sometimes they're brought down with a bullet. So I consider it praise if you consider me having any connection to philosophy of Malcolm X. So thank you.
Well, I do your rhetoric, your truth, your honesty, and your refusal to sell yourself out, to sell your soul, to sell your pride. Yeah, I wouldn't listen to you if it wasn't the truth, my man. I definitely wouldn't. But you had me busting the gut Monday about the porta potties and the geese. I cracked up.
I was thinking,
my daughter. Yeah, then I watched it on YouTube today. I had tears rolling down.
Oh, Lord have mercy. All right, well, listen, that's a lot of praise.
Hey, all the best to you and yours.
Take care, man. Thank you, CG. I appreciate it. A lot of praise, which I usually get very shy of. And still am, but thanks, CG. Nice thing to say. I mean, seriously, nice to say. Thank you. Appreciate it. Ann is in Albuquerque, listening on AM 1350. Hello, Ann.
Hey.
Hi.
Gosh, I've been listening while I've been on hold, and so I will say, as a child in England, although I know the name George Henty, I never read any of his books.
Mm-hmm.
And I had time to check the Encyclopedia Britannica, which I own because I'm an old librarian. I couldn't live without one, and he's not even in there.
Mm-hmm.
But he is on Wikipedia, so, you know. And I looked at the titles of his books, and I thought, well, they look like sort of English colonial history books. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, I can imagine that they would be kind of strange for homeschool kids who don't have any alternative.
Right.
What I really wanted to say was when you started at the top of the hour with the response to the New York Times letter.
Mm-hmm.
I was just blown away by that, and I just wanted to tell you, although I have grown children, I do not have grandchildren,
mm-hmm.
and I am really glad I don't.
I can understand that sentiment very easily, Anne. It's difficult. And I only speak for myself here, but I'm sure a lot of people with children my Molly's age who are 6 years old, whether they're children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, is really immaterial. I have grandchildren about the same age too, by the way. And it is scary. I use the human survival mechanism called denial and avoidance when the attempt is made for me to think about what lies in store for these little kids. I can't, all little kids, I can't let myself start thinking about it because it just tears big holes, rips in my thoughts, and I can't handle it. So I do what evolution gave us as a means of coping with those things that are impossible to cope with, and that is avoidance and denial. But I certainly hear what you're saying.
Yeah, and I tutor kindergarten students in reading, and I look at those little kids, and I think, what is going to happen?
I know, and I think
it's
anyone,
very sad,
anyone.
But I really enjoy your program. I was talking to a woman today about you, and she's like, "Well, sometimes he just gets too wrought up." And I said, "I don't know. He says exactly what I feel, and so I listen to him."
Well, thanks, Anne. I appreciate it. You take care, okay?
Thank you, Mike.
All right.
Bye bye.
We'll be back after the break, and I have something you're going to like. The Karamazov question, variation on a theme by Dostoevsky. Stick around. You're going to like it. I'm telling you, don't be scared. Seven past the hour. This is the Molloy Show. Roz set this in. I want to share it with you very quickly here. And right before the break, I said, you're going to like this. Like is the wrong word. You're not going to like this at all. But it is kind of Dostoevsky-ish. It's titled The Karamazov Question. A man appeared in the doorway of the Oval Office. He wasn't noticed at first in the bustle around the desk of the president, where George W. Bush was preparing to announce to the world that the decapitation raid he had launched on Baghdad a few hours before was in fact the beginning of his long-planned, much-anticipated invasion of Iraq. A woman fussed with the president's hair, which had been freshly cut for the television appearance. A makeup artist dabbed delicate touches of rouge on the president's cheeks. Another attendant fluttered in briefly to adjust the president's tie, which, like the $6,000 suit the president was wearing, had arrived that morning from a Chicago courtier. As for the president's $900 designer shoes, which, as a recent news story had pointed out playfully, were not only made by the same Italian craftsman who supplied Saddam with footwear, but were also the same size and make as those ordered by the Iraqi dictator, they had been carefully polished earlier by yet another aide, even though they would, of course, be out of sight during the broadcast. In addition to all of this activity, The president's political advisors and speechwriters were also making last-minute adjustments to the brief speech while giving the president pointers about his delivery. Keep your gaze and your voice steady. Project firmness of purpose, confidence, calmness of character, and short phrases lightly punched. Don't worry, the breaks and stresses will be marked on the teleprompter, okay? It's little wonder that no one saw the man as he advanced slowly to the center of the room. He stood there silently until the sense of his presence crept up on the others. One by one, they turned to look at him, this unauthorized figure, this living breach of protocol. He was, in almost every sense, nondescript. He wore a plain suit of indeterminate color. His features and skin betrayed no particular race. He had no badge, no papers. How he had come to be here, where nothing is allowed that is not licensed by power. Then, more astonishing, they saw his companion, a 2-year-old girl, standing by his side. A mass of tousled hair framed her face. A plain red dress covered her thin body. She, too, was silent, but not as still as the man. Instead, she turned her head this way and that, her eyes wide with curiosity, drawn especially by the bright television lights that shone on the president. A Marine guard reached for his holster. But the man raised his hand gently, and the guard's movement was arrested. The aides in attendance stepped back, then stood rooted as if stupefied, their ranks forming a path from the man at the room's center to the president's desk. The president, brilliant in the light, alone retained the freedom to move and speak. "Who are you?" he asked, rising from his chair. "What do you want?" The man put his hand tenderly on the back of the girl's head and came forward with her. "I have a question for you and an opportunity," the man replied. "I've heard it said that you are righteous and wish to do good for the world." "I am," said the president. "I only wish to do God's will, as he in his wisdom reveals it to me. And his will is the whole good of the world. What's your question? What's this opportunity? Be quick. I have mighty business at hand." The man nodded. "If tonight you can guarantee the good of the world, peace and freedom, democracy and prosperity, now and forever. If tonight you could relieve the suffering of all those who labor under tyranny and persecution, all those who groan in poverty and disease, if tonight you could redeem the anguish of creation, past and future, now and forever. If tonight you could guarantee such a universal reconciliation by the simple expedient of taking this..." And here the man suddenly produced a black pistol and held it out to the president. "Taking this and putting a bullet through the brain of this little one here, just her, no one else, would you do it? That's my question. And this is your opportunity." With firmness of purpose, the president grasped the pistol and walked around the desk. With confidence, calmness, and steady hand, he pressed the barrel to the girl's head and pulled the trigger. Her eyes, which had grown even wider with her smile at the approach of the nicely dressed man and his rosy cheeks, her eyes went black with blood in the instant shattering of her skull. Her body spun around from the force of the shot once, twice, three times in all, then fell, her mutilated head flailing wildly in a heap on the floor of the Oval Office. At that moment, the man faded like a dream into nothingness. The aides in attendance, unfrozen, stepped back into their tasks. The room was again a whirl of activity, like a hive. The president, the dematerialized gun no longer in his hand, strode confidently back to his chair. He winked at a nearby aide and pumped his fist. "Feel good," he exulted. The speech went off without a hitch. The hair was perfect, the voice steady, the phrases short and lightly punched. No one saw the blood and bits of brain that clung to the president's $900 designer shoes. They were, of course, out of sight during the broadcast. The Karamazov question. And variations on a theme by Dostoevsky. Thanks, Roz, for sending it in. Have you, now again, as depressing as this program has been so far, coming up the third hour, solutions. Solutions. I've got them. I've got the solutions. All right. And you know, it's not brain, what am I trying to say? It's not brain surgery. It's not deep thinking, my solutions. It's just very simple. And I'm sure you've thought about it, but you haven't articulated it maybe. So, you know, don't miss it. I'm serious. I'm really serious. Coming up third hour. Solutions. You know, if I don't lose it and start screaming and frothing at the mouth like I do. Steve is in Austin, Texas, listening to Sirius. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
That was very heavy by Ross.
Say what?
That was some pretty heavy thoughts there by Ross.
I'm not sure who wrote it, but it reads like Dostoevsky. It reads like a Russian novelist. When Kathy and I lived in Chicago, we both spent some time reading. There's a big Russian Jewish community in Chicago, not far from where we lived at the time.
Right.
And we would go to the Russian bookstores. And, you know, I discovered writers that, of course, most of us Americans never heard of unless we took literature courses at college, which I never did. And the writing is just fascinating.
Yeah. Well, at least second or third year for sure in college.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Regarding your first thoughts when you first opened the show about feeling about the war dead.
Uh-huh.
And noting the ages and the lost lives, literally. I don't think you did so just because of Molly alone, although that was certainly very contributory. But I think you would be just as fervent because you have conscience.
Well, I would like to think that, but I think the point I was trying to make, Steve, is that when you have the custody, so to speak, of a child, because we don't own our children, we just have temporary custody of them. When you have custody of a child, you see, and you're as old as I am, you see in a sense, you see everything, because one can look back at one's own past. Let me put you on hold. We'll come back after the break, Steve. One can look back at one's own past and note the milestones in one's own life and how that affected and changed and permutated and screwed with your opinion, your outlook, your determination, your sense of reality. And then if you're watching a child over whom you have temporary custody, I don't know how else to say it. It's scary. My other children, I was much younger, and I didn't have that arc of perception that you have when you've been on the planet for a number of years, more than 30 or 40 or 50, if you know what I mean.
We'd like to play hockey, have kids and grow old. Fighters for Texaco.
Time to practice your synchronized screaming. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Back to Steve in Austin, Texas. All right, where were we?
We were speaking regarding the reportage of the lost Americans in these two detestable wars.
Right, right.
Your intensity is that of more evolved. grandparent and parent as well, and I feel that as well. And just one other thing, it is related. The caller just before the top of the hour mentioned your hate and your anger. Hate is such a loaded word and such overused. I like detestable. I like a lot of other adjectives other than that.
Mm-hmm.
But hate is learned. Anger is innate. My way of thinking. And It's okay.
Well, I would, but the hate.
I don't know.
I would mildly disagree with that, Steve, because to me, hate is just another aspect of fear. And fear is a survival mechanism. It's there as surely as your footprints are there. We only hate the things we fear, or the things that we think have power over us, and that also equates fear. And I think fear is innate. Fear is there. I mean, the newest of the newborns have two essential fears: fear of falling and the fear of loud noises. So fear comes with the package that becomes a human being. So I would tend to agree with CG. I hear what you're saying. I mildly disagree. Bigotry is learned.
Right.
Prejudice is learned, but I think fear is just or hate, I should say, is just one of the faces of fear. Hate is one of the faces of fear, just like that Roman god Janus, you know, looking this way and looking that way. That's a workable explanation for me, because I hear what you're saying, and I used to question that about myself. How can you hate? You must have learned this. It's because I fear these people. I fear that they're destroying everything that decent people have built in this country since the 1930s. And I fear them because they are destroying the future for my six-year-old, and I won't be here to protect her. So I would tend to agree with CG, but by the same token, Steve, I hear loud and clear what you're saying, too. Let me move on, pal. I appreciate what you had to say. Have I got time now? I don't have time to do... there's something here Prairie 2 wrote that I want to get in. We'll do it after the break at the bottom of the hour. Linear Bob is in San Jose, listening on KKGN. Hey, Linear.
Yeah, hi. It's been a while. You and I are about the same age.
Yeah.
And I think what we're really talking about is an existential question. It's really the same question Cindy Sheehan was asking.
Yeah.
You know, why did her young son have to die?
Right, right. Well, you're right. Yeah, sure.
And I think connected to this is why one of the solutions, and I don't know if it's a really good one, is what I think the Iroquois Confederation came up with, was when it came to fighting wars, mm-hmm. only the women could vote.
As to whether or not to declare war.
They would go to war.
That's,
women are more concerned. They have the lives, you know, they talk about concern for the seven generations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think it's only, we're older. We can appreciate it in age. But if we're like 25 or 30 and you know, all full of testosterone and stuff, we might not think that much.
No, that's true. That's very true. That's why the old saying, old men make the wars, young men go to fight them. Is the only thing missing from that is the word crazy. Crazy old men
make, that is so true.
Make the wars. I mean, war is what presents itself when your country has gone insane, where it becomes rational to think about mutual killing on a scale that is matched only by army ants in the middle of the Amazon. It's just unbelievable that we humans, after a couple million years of distinct development away from other creatures, that we still use this, that we still decide to go kill, knowing that we're going to be killed in return. I don't get it. I would think that our species would have evolved beyond that, but we certainly...
Well, some of us maybe have. You know, this is why we're talking about this question, why somebody wrote that letter to the editor.
Yeah, that's very true.
To some extent, we're a little bit above army ants like that regard.
Well, I wonder, because there are very few species, Bob, that, as you know, very few species that practice war within the species. Just very few of them orchestrate a war. Bob, I got to leave it there. Thanks, pal. Don't be a stranger. I'd like to hear from you a little bit more often. Take care. We'll be right back.
I live my life
right here, right now, Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Yeah, stick around, third hour. I'm going to try this. Don't try it at home yourself. It could hurt you. But I have, I think, I've compiled this list. I have solutions that I'm going to offer tonight to everything, all of it. Oh, and by the way, thanks to Sheila. Either Roz forgot to send it or whatever, but Sheila writes in that that piece about the president blowing little girls' brains out and then going back about his business of declaring war, that was written by Chris Floyd, we should have guessed. And it appeared in the Moscow Times in April of 2003, the Karamazov question, variation on a theme by Dostoevsky. So thanks, Sheila, and thank Roz. Thanks, Roz. I appreciate the fact that both of you let me know about that. All right, time for our sometimes nightly missive from Prairie 2, then back to your phone calls. Listen up here. Subject line, I told you to invest in canned goods. Uh-oh. Brace yourself, Bruce writes, for the next big food shortage. Okay, we in the U.S. probably won't be starving, but prepare to pay more, perhaps a lot more. Russia is still in the grip of a major drought that has extended their ban on grain exports. Normally, they are the fourth largest exporter of wheat in the world. Not a kernel will be crossing the border for at least another year, and they weren't promising anything after that. A good deal of what the Russians export goes to countries where many people spend more than half their income for food. A 30% increase in the price of bread has already caused widespread rioting in Maputo and Mozambique, leaving many dead and hundreds injured. Prices have surged 70% on European markets since January and have already exceeded the peak during the last food crisis that toppled governments in Haiti and Madagascar. The truth is, there is no shortage. Not even close. Food, though, will rot in the warehouses while people starve because Wall Street bankers and similar scum around the world want to suck piles of money out of hungry people and out of the rest of us, too. Seeing starving people rioting will motivate the rest of us not to haggle over the price of canned goods and will increase the demand as those who can afford it will stock up. The last artificial shortage put a billion people into slow starvation and resulted in untold deaths. The bankers don't even need to hoard the food themselves until it rots. They just need to control enough of the supply with futures contracts. This will panic various governments that can afford to buy food ahead of time to do the hoarding out of fear they won't be able to get food when they need it. If you want to stay in power, you need to make sure the bread is on time and the circus is entertaining. Wall Street bankers make out like bandits up and down the line. Not only will they reap huge rewards on commodity trading, including derivatives that require nothing but pieces of paper to generate billions in profits, but also they will make loans to governments and NGOs that are trying to deal with the manufactured crisis that Wall Street creates. These loans are often backed by the taxpayer, and the NGOs must waste money paying double or triple for grain and cut other worthwhile projects. Plus, the more food they distribute, the more this disrupts local markets, and this cripples food production, making a phony problem into a real problem. In theory, the world has twice as much food as it needs, with obscene amounts wasted by glutinous Westerners, and from losses to rats and insects in the third world that eat or spoil half the food. But the greed of the so-called free market is the biggest waste of food by creating uncertainty in the markets that constantly interferes with production. The same mega food corporations then uses the mess they've created to push out small producers in order to create efficiency in production, further concentrating their control. There is far less objection to their Frankenfoods if people are hungry or can be panicked into thinking they will be. The corporate model requires that a fairly high percentage of people are hungry all the time, or the corporations aren't maximizing profits. But the circuses are great, aren't they? Prairie 2. You can go to his website, prairie2.com. And you should go there. Paul is in Canton, Georgia. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm all right. How about you?
Okay. A couple of quick things for you. One, I was wondering if you had ever caught any episodes of Max Kaiser's show at all.
Say it again. Episodes of
Max
what?
Max Kaiser.
Max Kaiser?
Yeah, he does financial reports.
No, no, I'm not the least. I'm not familiar with him at all, Paul.
If you get a chance to check on, you can check stuff online.
Okay.
He's also on satellite if you have it. He talks. He was mentioning the other day about how. Do you remember when Soupy Sales asked kids to send in a dollar and got in trouble with the FCC?
Yeah, he got in deep trouble.
Yeah, he was mentioning that.
Oh, my God, do I remember that? Yeah. That's awful.
He was mentioning that Beck and Palin are in a similar thing. He just doesn't understand why, if the FCC was really doing their job, idiots like them wouldn't be on TV.
Oh, well, come on, Paul. Freedom of screech.
Yeah,
it's all there. Can you see Palin and Beck just screaming and stomping their feet and Beck crying and pointing to the sky and Palin looking around for demons to cast out if somebody said, why don't the two of you sit the hell down and shut up?
Exactly.
Oh,
and,
my God.
Speaking of, and with the Beck thing, I think that the rally last week was a complete and utter failure for him. Even if you took their numbers, which are wrong, but just for their argument's sake, I think the real reason he had it when he did, at the time he did, was to try to start some violence, to start a riot, a race riot, essentially, and then blame it on Obama.
Oh,
nothing
sure.
Happened, so he looked like an idiot for doing this.
Right. I think that's exactly. I said there was going to be violence at that event, and there was violence. There was violence done further violence to the very fabric of this country. Beck and Palin are all about violence. That's all they
right.
do.
And did you see the highlights of Jan Brewer making a complete idiot of herself, not even knowing what her accomplishments were?
I did. Yeah, right before my program, I usually watch as much of Oberman as I can, and I saw those video cuts. I think she might have some sort of, I wouldn't be surprised if it, and I'm not being a smartass here, I wouldn't be surprised if it turns out she gets diagnosed with a brain anomaly, a meningioma or a brain tumor or brain cancer. Because the going blank like that and just kind of staring off into space on a couple of occasions during the debate and then after the debate, that's usually, I'm certainly not a neurosurgeon. Half of what I say, in the medical field is pretty much guesswork, but I swear to God, that kind of reaction to questions. I mean, there is the political thing of ignoring a question, but to me, that wasn't right. Ignoring a question. I think Ms. Brewer ought to get a scan done to see just how much longer she's got to live.
Plus, she didn't want to answer the question about the decapitations after the press conference after.
Right, but she just went completely blank. I can understand why she wouldn't want to answer anything. She's as crazy as the rest of these loons. But I'm talking about the actual physiological reaction to watch her. They rebroadcast Oberman's program around the country. I think here in the East, they're rebroadcasting it right now. But if you get a chance to see Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona, I think she's a kook and a crazy loon. But on the other hand, I honestly believe if she asked me, Mike, do you think I ought to see a doctor? I would say, oh, yeah, I really do. Thanks, Paul. I got to leave it there. Yeah, I really do. There is something inside her skull that is, I think, is physiological, it's real, and it is interfering with all those neurotransmitters that try to, that we all use to try to, A, stay upright, and B, be able to communicate with each other. You know what I'm saying? Of course you do. You know what I'm saying? I know you do. I know you know. Another thing I heard on Oberman's program tonight, on September 11th, the right-wing the real neo-Nazis in this country. Beck is not a neo-Nazi, neither is Palin. They are clowns. They're destroyers. They're sick people. But John Bolton, the former appointed UN ambassador, Newt Gingrich, Jordan Sekulow from the crazy Christian answer to the ACLU, Breitbart, the lying scum sucker that puts out phony videos, all these people are going to be speakers at a demonstration on September 11th of 2001 near so-called Ground Zero, speakers against the mosque. And so many of families of the 9/11 survivors are begging people not to do this. And they're only doing it for political reasons. They're only doing it because these son of a bitches ought to be somehow ejected from the planet. But until they are, I guess we're going to continue to have to put up with this. Unless we figure out a way to not put up with it. Before the hour, stick around because I've got lots of answers to solutions, really, coming up next hour. A couple emails here. Bob in Miami writes, Mike, I hate when people use the word hate when they should be saying hatred. Hate is a verb. Hatred is a noun. Watch out for the destruction of our language, Bob in Miami. I seem to hear echoes of my 6th or 7th grade English teacher telling me the same thing. I'm sorry, Bob. I really am, but I'll probably do it again. Cat Mary in Memphis writes in from George Bernard Shaw's Man and Superman the following. Mendoza says to Tanner, I am a brigand. I live by robbing the rich. Tanner replies, I am a gentleman. I live by robbing the poor. Guess which one has the Republican attitude? Captain Mary. Program note, tomorrow night this program will be a rebroadcast of something. I don't know what. Monday, we should be back from our little trip up the road to stay with some friends in the North Georgia Mountains and hang out for a while. All right. Steven is in Burbank, California. Hello, Steven.
Hello, Mike. Steve from Austin is so great. Everything he said is 100% valid. Or should I say he has extreme validity or whatever.
Valid is not a verb.
I know. I don't know the difference between a transient modifier and an adverb.
No, Bob is right, though. Hatred is the verb. Hate is the... Our hatred is the noun. Hate is the verb. But anyway...
So I'm sure you've heard that fear is the firstborn of ignorance. No doubt about it. You've heard that phrase, that little metaphor. Fear is the firstborn of ignorance.
Okay.
And you've also heard the phrase tabula rasa.
Right.
Blank tablet.
Right.
And on Tuesday, I was yammering about the societal syndrome to, bring up the children to try and survive in the cold, cruel, hostile world. That's how we are evolved. Every creature, you, me, my cat, birds that fly, we are all evolved to try and survive in a hostile environment.
Right.
And because man being the, quote, either herd animal or social animal or I should say humanity, that we group together and then we try to cooperate for our survival. And that's where democracy comes in. But with the way the manipulators operate, they do something, they manipulate through hatred, because we experience rage, we experience anger. That's not hatred. Hatred is the residue, it's the byproduct. And the way to unload from that load is some perspective is through violence. And we try to avoid that because we are trying to evolve. We are trying to get beyond our base instincts of nature. I mean, the laws of nature and the laws of civilization are different. You take civilization in the jungle, it destroys the jungle. You take the jungle into the laws of into civilization, and civilization is destroyed.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Ayn Rand, you know, get tough or die, you know, look what's happening. We're getting steamrolled.
Oh, God.
So I don't know if that's a monkey ranch, but anyway, when people recommend me to read books, and I never, the only book I ever recommended, that I read that somebody recommended was Kurt Vonnegut Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Not Junior, but Kurt Vonnegut in Man Without a Country. He said, get Hervey Cleckley, The Mask of Sanity. It was published in 1941, and I had the fourth edition from 1964.
It's good.
And I read it.
The Mask of Sanity? I'm not familiar with that one at all. Boy, do I feel stupid.
It's about sociopaths and psychopaths. And it stated that 4 out of 100 people in society are borderline sociopaths and psychopaths, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, don't even bother to try to distinguish between the two. You have to be an advanced, you know, you got to have a PhD in psychology.
That was written in 1941?
Okay, it was written in 1941, and I have the fourth edition that was published in 1964.
Well, the reason I asked, that was right around the time that Philip Wiley wrote Generation of Vipers. Have you ever read that one?
I've heard the title. I never got around to reading it.
Yeah, the title is taken from the Bible, but Generation of Vipers was very prescient. Wiley was the one that came up with the term. You may be too young to have known this term, momism, referencing mother, momism. This is back in the day when Freudian psychology was still blaming mothers for everything. But the bigger points that Wiley made in Generation of Vipers, he was referring to us, the United States. He was saying that the people in, and this was, I guess he wrote it right before we got involved in World War II, but there's a recommendation for you, because it was written about the same time as the Vonnegut book that you're talking about. So there's your assignment for the weekend, read Generation of Vipers. It's not fiction. It's nonfiction. It's just a book-length essay on how screwed up Wiley, Philip Wiley, saw the country, the society, in 1940 damn one. Now, I haven't read it in 30 years, but I'll bet you it would still apply. Hey, I got to leave there. Steven, have a good weekend, all right?
Yeah, boss.
All right, man, take care. All right, quick break. We'll be back. Stay with us. Don't forget, coming up next hour, solutions to everything. You're going to love this. Stay with me. I'm Mike Malloy. 7 past the hour. You're still listening to the Molloy program. This morning, I didn't mention this earlier tonight, but this morning, over at Molly's school, her public elementary school, there was an event, a fun run. It's a fundraiser. All the public schools are in deep trouble all over the country, but the school that Molly goes to, I've mentioned this before, has very active PTA, a lot of parental involvement, great staff. Molly's first grade teacher has been at the same school for 16 years. I love this school. And this is her first year there. But they had this fundraising event. Now, what my grandkids will do when they have fundraisers is sell Christmas cards or popcorn or wrapping paper. It makes you crazy. This was a fun run where the kids get sponsors to pay either $1, $2, $3, $5 a lap, and then the kids get together and run laps, and for every lap they get the money from the people that made the pledges. It's a great idea. I'm here to report that Molly ran 32 laps. 34 laps, and 16 of them was the 16 equaled a mile. So I can't believe this kid ran 2 miles this morning after breakfast, but she did. And we were just proud of her. Now, the reason I tell you that story, we found out from the school administration that this year, the fund run had generated more money than they had ever generated. Not because the people that send kids to the school are wealthy. They're not. They're just, you know, middle class. It is, after all, a public school. But simply because the parents all got together and decided to support their children. Now, the kids loved it because they get T-shirts and little doodads and stuff for getting the pledges and then for running the race. But on the way home after this event this morning, Kathy and I were talking about the necessity, not that we see that this fun run is something bad, it's good. These kids, to get that kind of exercise is great. But the necessity of depending on the children to be primarily responsible for raising money for the school is kind of eye-opening. Kathy and I fully support this. We think it's a great idea. We support the administration and the teachers that did this. We think it's a wonderful idea. But if you move back a little bit and take a look at the idea that public schools, especially in the Metro Atlanta area, that would be the 12 counties that make up Metro Atlanta, and it's true all over the country, that public school systems are on the verge of completely collapsing. Now, the capitalists in this country, and the right-wingers, and the Glenn Becks, and the Sarah Palins, and the drooling idiots that follow these people, love that idea. Why should there be public schools? As Neil Bortz calls them, government schools. Crazy bastard. Because without public education, without universal education, and with the economic situation the way it is in this country right now, you have immediately produced for you a class of drones, a class of people, uneducated, no skills, who will work for very cheap wages, kind of like the Vietnamese, no offense if you're Vietnamese, but kind of like the way people around the globe respond to Chinese or American economic imperialism or British economic imperialism or whoever's doing the economic imperialistic dance. Work for whatever you can get, because if you don't get it, you have nothing. So the model for the United States is slowly and surely developing into that model. Now, in the meantime, the drooling idiots in this country that follow the Becks and the Limbaughs and the Palins and the rest of these and the Malkins and the rest of these monsters, the drooling idiots are willing to have their minds completely focused on whether or not Barack Obama was born in the United States and is he a Muslim? That's the central theme for these drooling idiots that follow Beck and the rest of the capitalist stooges that are making sure that America collapses into a mass of underpaid, underfed, undereducated, worker bees who will do nothing but move stuff around. And then maybe, you see, maybe some of the industries will come back to this country, because at that point, it'll be cheaper to hire the broken, battered American worker than to hire the rising Asian worker, or the rising Latin American worker, you understand, or the rising African worker. So we were talking about this coming home, and of course, I have solutions to everything, as I'm sure you do. I have solutions to the economic disaster in this country. It's two-part. And let's just leave my democratic socialist ideas aside for a moment. And I've talked about this before. First of all, the infrastructure. This country could use, what is it, the American Society of Structural Engineers or Mechanical Engineers. I forget the exact organization. But $2.3 trillion. That's $2,300 billion that are desperately needed to prevent this country from crumbling into what? I don't know, just collapsed rocks and pipes and junk. We do not have leadership at all, not in the executive branch, not in the legislative branch, to bring about such a thing, to focus $2 trillion over the next decade on the infrastructure of the United States. Now, we will spend $2 trillion over the next 5 years, you see, or four, on weaponry and death and destruction and the War Department and invading other countries and super sophisticated modern weapon systems. We will do that, which benefits nobody except a very select group of workers who are involved in the death industry in this country. I don't know how they go home and eat dinner at night, knowing that what they're doing in the factories during the day, the weapons industry factories, is going to result, what they do during the day, is going to result in the death of innocent people all over the globe. Because if we're not using those weapons, we sell them to whomever wants to use them. The Saudis, the Israelis, the Germans, the South Africans, I don't know, the Indonesians, the Filipinos, the Japanese. We are the biggest exporters of death and destruction in the history of the human race. So, what if we diverted that money? And, you know, we've talked about this before. You've thought about it. I've thought about it. Supposing instead of spending $2 trillion over the next 5 years, that we spent the same amount of money over the next 10 years rebuilding the infrastructure of the United States. Immediate results. First of all, we turn this not government corporations, you teabag morons, you Beck dribbling freaks. No, we turn this over to private industry, solid, legitimate businesses that know how to do this sort of thing, preferably smaller engineering firms that design this, American engineering firms that design this reconstruction, and then construction companies that are required, first and foremost, to hire legitimate Americans to do the work. And there's a reason I say legitimate Americans to do the work. I'm not talking about people with proper documentation. I'm talking about the American worker, because it's the American worker right now who is dying, literally dying, as he or she watches his family or her family die. We're all headed for a great pit of corpses unless something is done. All right, that's the infrastructure. We can rebuild this nation over the next decade and recirculate $2 or $3 trillion that will become very quickly, if every dollar spent equals three more dollars in tangential industries, we're talking about $6-7 trillion that will begin circulating real money circulated by labor, products being used, real money circulating through the economy, which would save this nation completely. That's A. B, when we come back.
I'm
the hour. All right, so Malloy's solution to this, Plan A, the infrastructure rebuilding that we've talked about in this program several times, and we seem not to have any leadership that's at least a bit interested in this. This is what has one of the things, one of several, that convinced me that Barack Obama is nothing more than another corporate anointed fill-in leader until this country reverts to complete totalitarian fascism. And I don't think that day is too far off unless something unforeseen right now, at least unforeseen by me, occurs to stop it. Obama could begin this process of infrastructure building very simply, very directly. It doesn't need Republican cooperation. To hell with the filthy Republicans. To hell with the dribbling, brain-dead Beckites. To hell with all of it. You know, we focus too much, including me, on the negative, on how these people, these vermin, these scum, who are always with us. There will always be vermin, right-wing vermin, and right-wing scum. Occasionally, they take over, as they did in Nazi Germany, as they did in Imperial Japan, as they did in Franco Spain, but and Mussolini. Italy, but eventually, and I could go on and on, but eventually they're defeated and they're burned at the stake and they're removed from having any position of power and they're relegated to what they are supposed to be, a noisy bunch of cockroaches in the back of the room that you occasionally spray raid at. You understand what I'm saying? So, infrastructure building is one. You know what number two is? Number two is to install tariffs, reinstall tariffs, import tariffs on everything not made here. Everything from bathroom tissue to drywall to automobiles to steel framing, everything that is not made in the United States. Slap an enormous tariff on it and watch how long it takes the capitalist pigs who used American workers until they were rich enough and had passed enough legislation to dump the American worker into the nearest open pit and move on to Mexico, China, Vietnam, Indonesia, the North Mariana Islands, someplace in Africa, or wherever these capitalist swine have decided to go in order to reduce massively their labor costs. The first tariff enacted in this country, and I did some research, it was the Hamilton Tariff, named after Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton. It occurred on July 4th, 1789. It was specifically recorded on that particular day because at the time it was referred to as the Second Declaration of Independence. Most of the tariffs, the rates of the tariffs that the Hamilton Law put into effect were between 5% and 10%. It was the first tariff and the second statute ever enacted by the new federal government of the United States. And it was enacted for a very specific reason, because in spite of all their faults, these white nascent capitalists, although agrarian-style capitalists, property owners, slave owners, genocide committers, in spite of all that, the framers understood that if products were not built here and bought and sold here, that imports, foreign-made goods, would eventually move in and take over and destroy from within the American economy. Alexander Hamilton was anxious to establish the tariff also as a regular source of government revenue, not just to protect the things that we made here, but as a form of government revenue. You want to sell your products in the United States? Fine. Here's the price of admission. If you are a domestic producer of product, fine. There is no price of admission because you're here. Now, as a regular source of government revenue, Hamilton knew that had to go into effect immediately if this young country was going to have any kind of financial backing so it would survive. Hamilton knew that we would be attacked by the British. He knew that other countries would be very interested in seeing that we failed. So how do you raise revenue? Taxes, property taxes, please. Income taxes, what income? How do you tax somebody's crop? So tariffs. If it's not produced here, if it's not manufactured here, and you want to sell it here, then here's what it's going to cost you to bring your product into the United States. Now, what effect would that have on the American capitalists that we now have in this country? The pigs who have abandoned us, the ones who bolted the factories in, for example, Flint, Michigan, and took everything and moved it to China or Mexico or someplace else. What will happen to those capitalist pigs when they finally realize that the products they're producing for dirt wages in some other country, and those products are brought to this country, and the door is shut unless they pay a tariff? What do you think will happen? That's number three. We'll get to that when we come back.
This is an important...
Filtered only with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Okay, so step one, the infrastructure rebuilding of this nation, which immediately puts people back to work and provides jobs in the manufacturing sector as well as the construction sector. And all of the sectors of the economy that are tangential to those two primary engines of job creation in the country, manufacturing and construction. You know one that employs more people traditionally or historically in this country? I don't. The second step is tariffs, huge, huge tariffs imposed on products not made in this country, but products that the manufacturers want to sell in this country. Now, a lot of those manufacturers are or were American-based corporations who decided to do like any greedy, destructive capitalist will do eventually, and that is to find cheaper source of labor. The capitalists would like to drive every price down, the price of raw materials, natural resources, the price of destruction to the environment, anything that they can drive down, because the driving force of capitalism is what it says it is, capital. People, it's not peopleism, it's not humanism, it's not let's make jobs for everybody-ism, it is capitalism. So the capitalists all of a sudden, the American capitalists or the international capitalists are faced with a horrible situation. Ooh, and aren't they going to get pissy? All of a sudden the United States says, you that car you built in China, you want to sell it in the United States, that car you built in Japan, you want to sell it over here, all right, there's a 30% tariff on it. Go ahead, bring it, sell it. But the price of getting into our market is 30% of the value of your car. Well, how long do you think it would take before the capitalists realize that, now there would be some dancing back and forth. There would be pull and push. And I'm sure Tom Hartman can address this better than I can because he's smarter than me. But after the pull and push was completed, would there not come a time when the American capitalists, all of a sudden, like in the cartoons, a light bulb over his head? Huh? And he would say, or she would say, it's mostly he would say, golly, I think I can make a better profit. That's all capitalism is about. I think I can make a better profit by moving back to Flint, Michigan. opening the decaying building that I walked away from 30 years ago, taking the machinery out of the factories here in China, all this nice shiny machinery I bought because labor costs over here are a 20th or a 10th of what they were in the United States. I think I'll move everything back to the United States. Then I'm not subject to the tariffs. I'm not subject to international relations between countries that may result in the glomming up of my assets. You think? You think that would happen? And then everything from coat hangers to light bulbs to bathroom tissue to the chemicals that go into your child's candy. Instead of being made in China or Vietnam or Sierra Leone or South Africa or Moldova or Tajikistan, it would be made here. Now, what would happen where it concerns globalization? It would collapse. Yay! Yay! What would happen to NAFTA and GATT and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and all these pro-capitalist organizations who don't give a goddamn about any human life anywhere on Earth, especially not here? What would happen to them? They would cease to exist. There would no longer be international banking institutions that could go into countries and say, well, now I'll tell you what, the first thing you're going to have to do here, if you want to borrow some money, get rid of the socialized medicine. It's got to open up to the pharmaceutical industrial complex and the chemists and everybody, and so on and so forth. No more International Monetary Fund, no more World Bank. Oh, but Mike, what about the starving billions who want a dam built in their country? Very simple. A, educate your people to build their own dam. Or B, hire people to come and do it for you. But you don't have to C, destroy the social fabric of your country in order to get the money from the World Bank to do it. Your public school system will stay intact if you have one. Your public health system will stay intact if you have one. Isn't this simple? So step three, tell the capitalists that you better come your asses back home and go back to making maybe 20% profit instead of 2,000%, you greedy sons of bitches. Come on back to the United States. Now, a lot of the capitalists, of course, would immediately fight that. They would try to engineer war between the United States and China. Or they would try to engineer war between the United States and India. Or between India and Germany. Whatever. That's what the capitalists do. Because if you're a capitalist, you win more if there's a global conflict, then you do when there's peacetime. And if the answer to that is not immediately obvious to you, you must be a teabagger, beck sucker. So the attempt to engineer global conflict will be there. And that's where the American people, through its elected representatives, have got to resist, have got to say no. You have to become a war resister. Now, if somebody shows up on the shores of New Jersey or the shores of San Diego and are deciding to come into our country and kill our people, well, then we have to react, don't we? But all of a sudden, if we remember, the first part of this is we shift the trillions of dollars that we now spend on exporting death, we shift it into our infrastructure. And one of the unintended, or maybe it is intended, side effects of all this, if we are not providing death and weaponry and means of murder and supporting right-wing dictatorships around the planet, no matter who they are, all of a sudden, we no longer face a problem of terrorism. Because all of a sudden, we are not the number one exporter of death and destruction and the means to accomplish both on Earth. So who's going to hate us? Regardless of what George Bush and the rest of these dolts have said over the past 30 years, they do not hate us because we build houses. They hate us because we destroy their countries one way or the other. And why do we do that? Because they have stuff we want. A. No, not oil. A. No, not natural resources. A. Cheap labor. Then B. Natural resources, oil, so on and so forth. But if there are no people in a country, and it takes a million people to dig holes in the ground to get the natural resources out, what are you going to do? Import a million people? No, of course not. You don't go there. So there you have it. A, number one, the infrastructure rebuilding of this country financed by ending the death industry. B, install tariffs on everything. I don't care what it is that's not made in this country. And they are punitive tariffs. They are tariffs that make the manufacturer realize, well, you know what? It'd be cheaper for me to come home to America or even go build a factory in America if you are some foreign country. You want to sell your geeky little Chinese cars in the United States? Fine. You come over here, and the first thing you do is sit down with United Auto Workers, and you work out a contract. Then you can make your cars here. Otherwise, it's going to cost you, dear Mr. and Mrs. Chinese imperialist capitalists. But the ones I'm primarily concerned with are these filthy, stinking American capitalists who have gutted the country. They have destroyed us. They are taking us into a burial pit. And in the meantime, the mouth-breathing, drooling teabag freaks want you to focus on whether or not Barack Obama has a birth certificate. And there's a reason why they want you to focus on that. Because the Beckoids are being manipulated by Beck, who is being paid by corporate America to do the manipulating. You understand that, of course. I am addressing now the 10 or 20 half-assed right-wingers who are listening to this program trying to figure out what I'm talking about. You half-assed right-winger, are sealing your own fate, your death, your children's death, your grandchildren's. Wake up! Following Glenn Beck to the Lincoln Memorial gets you nothing, you moron. Listening to Michelle Bachmann talk to you about Jesus coming gets you nothing. But rebuilding the infrastructure of the United States, imposing tariffs, ending the death industry, and therefore stopping terrorism, you know, that's not a bad idea. So that pretty much is the solution to everything, okay? Wasn't that easy? You know, I'll just summarize very quickly. Divert money from our death industry into infrastructure rebuilding. Trillions of dollars, immediate construction jobs, immediate manufacturing jobs, people go back to work. Install tariffs on everything not made here that would make the capitalists wet their pants. And somehow immunize the Congress so that the corporatists can't get to our members of Congress. You see, this requires leadership. I realize that. So spare me the emails over the weekend that says, Mike, that'll never work because, you know, we don't have leadership. I know we don't have leadership. I'm saying if we had leadership, this is the way out. I can't fix everything, right? So I'm just going to try to fix this. Install tariffs on all products not made here, punitive tariffs. I mean, really badass tariffs. And if people don't like it, if the capitalists don't like it, tell them to go straight to hell. If they want this vast American market, and we still are, even with all the crap, we're still the number one economy on earth. Now, how much longer is this going to last unless we do something? And then the third thing is the realization that the capitalists will come back to this country once they realize they can't get around it. And, of course, the fourth thing, with the military, with our country no longer intervening militarily in the business of other countries, whether it is their political business or their economic business or their natural resource business, all of a sudden there are no Americans around to hate. There's no military around stomping on stuff and killing people and turning babies into red mist. Oh, my goodness. So who are they going to hate? Well, let them hate some goddamn body else. All of a sudden, they don't hate us. Because why? Because we're gone. We're not killing them. We're not stealing from them. We're not overthrowing their governments and destabilizing their countries. We've gone home. Excuse the language. Neoclassic economics, the kind that the capitalists push, those theories hold that tariffs are a harmful interference with the individual freedom and the laws of the free market. Well, they are. That's the whole point, because the free market isn't free. The capitalists believe that it is unfair toward consumers and generally disadvantageous for a country to artificially maintain an industry made inefficient by local demands. That's what they tell you. Well, globalization, that makes everything more efficient. No, it doesn't. It makes everything cheaper. And the neoclassical economic capitalists who are against tariffs believe it is better to allow an economy to collapse than it is to impose tariffs. Now, could that be any clearer to you, truth seeker, what the goal of the capitalists in this country really is? Could it? Opposing all tariffs is part of the lying free trade principle. It is not free. It is not trade. And one thing it damn sure isn't is a principle. The World Trade Organization, their goal is to eliminate tariffs, to destroy a country's way of protecting itself economically, providing decent jobs and a decent life for its inhabitants, and turning everybody on earth into a goddamn slave. I'm sorry, I said it again. I'm very, very angry at what I see going on, especially when I see the bet thugs clustering around the Lincoln Memorial with their mouths open and snot dribbling out of their noses while this freak stands up there and talks about, "Whoa, we gotta come back to God! Oh, look at the geese!" There's a way out of this. There is a way out of this. This weekend we are supposed to celebrate, oh my God, grab your gag reflex. You got it? Labor Day. At a time when unions have been dismissed as a communist front organization and have been strangled thanks to Reagan and the ensuing 30 years, at a time when people can't get a 4% refi loan on their house because they owe too much or there's no job, so they don't qualify. There's a way out of this, truth seeker. And it's a very simple. And the thing that gets me, a lot of people much smarter than I will say, well, Malloy, it's not simple. Jesus Christ, what are you talking about here? I mean, you're talking about disrupting the global economy. Yes, I really, really am. You betcha. And then other countries can do the same thing if they want to. If they don't, to hell with them. I am not concerned about the gross domestic product of Sri Lanka. I really am not. Does that make me a hard-ass liberal? I'm concerned about what goes on here for my tribe, the people that live in this country, the people who busted their ass to build this country, and the capitalists took advantage of the ass busting, and then when the time was right, thanks to four presidents, they turned their backs on the American worker and the American middle class and the American working class and everybody except the ultra rich. And the American capitalists said, go screw yourselves. We don't care if your schools collapse. We don't care if your healthcare system, as crappy as it is, collapses. We don't care if your infrastructure collapses. We don't care if your business model collapses. And you know what, truth seekers? Take a look around you. It is all collapsing. You want to save it? Replay this third hour of the program tonight. I'll see you Tuesday. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.